You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Mike McNamara with you. Good morning to you. I'm getting fired up, headed to MCRD to do post-traumatic winning next week, and I'm getting fired up about it. So, yeah. The Peyton Davis is going to join me down there, so excited to finally meet Peyton in person, and she's going to be part of it, so excited about that. And it changes a little bit. I think what I'd like to do is get some people that have that have seen it and understand the power of it to get them to do cameo appearances. Yeah, this stuff comes to me when I'm being creative, Mac. Yeah, I thought it would be good that, you know, you get a variety of leaders to record maybe, I don't know, 20-second video. Hey, I'm Corporal Mike McNamara, and in January, I got told I had to go to something, and I went, and I walked in thinking it would be 2.5 hours of my life I'd never get back, and it's had a huge effect on my life, so pay attention. Just something like that. I mean, not long, not verbose or long-winded, and then I had to see if General Furness would record something, but, you know, him talking about, hey, good morning, Marines and sailors and anybody else that's here. I'm Major General David Furness, 2nd Marine Division. I had Matt come and do this in January and did it again in April. And the bottom line is this. We've had one suicide in 2nd Marine Division among the Marines that have seen this presentation. So pay attention. And so, but, you know, coming from a variety of ranks, I mean, so what you're trying to do at the start is get everybody's attention, and for them to understand that they're not going to walk in and listen to some other. I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody else's efforts or anything like that, but certainly by the feedback that we've received, I've received in doing it. It's not normal. And it's all based in truth, and it certainly lands with a thud, and it needs no salesman. So, as I say. So anyway, I'm excited about going down to San Diego. Let's see, a week from yesterday. And then I think I'll do it on Wednesday and Thursday, and then Thursday night fly out to D.C. and got invited to go see the post in relief of the Commandant, or whatever the hell they call that thing. They don't call it the change of command. So it's something like that, post in relief of the Commandant. So hopefully that'll all happen. But fly all night, land, and I don't know, I don't know where I'll throw my stuff. Maybe I don't want to keep it at the airport, but, and I don't think, do they have lockers at airports anymore? I think they stopped doing that. You don't see them anymore. Remember at bus stations, and now it's a security thing. People put bombs and shit in there. So, so I don't think they do that anymore. I don't see it. So, anywho, yeah. But no, excited to go down to MCRD and talk about it. Interestingly enough, after the Commandant saw it, the only place he told me, the place he told me I needed to get to was the recruit depot. Interesting, right? Yeah. So, anyway, hopefully we'll get to both of them here in the not too distant future. So, I've had conversations with both and the head of TMCRD in San Diego. So, I'm excited about that. That's in my head now. As that gets closer. And watched the All-Star game last night, Major League Baseball All-Star game. Now I have to tell you, I'm not a big All-Star game person. Come on, you know, it's an exhibition game. Who cares? But I will say this, what Major League Baseball did and what Fox Sports did was different. They mic'd people up, they talked to them during the games, they kind of showcased the personalities of a lot of young players in Major League Baseball, and it was fun to watch. I watched the whole game, and normally I don't do that. And I just actually turned it on just to see kind of what was going on. As I went to pick up Colleen from being a candy striper, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. So, but you know, it's interesting. A couple interesting things. My attention gets grabbed by numbers, right? So they have played All-Star games since 1933. The American League now leads the series 45 victories. There have been two ties. And since 1988, the American League has won 24 of 31 games with one of the ties in there. Is that crazy or what? That they would dominate the All-Star game to that extent. 24 of the last 31 games they've won with one inning and a tie. That's amazing. The other thing that's amazing is how the age in the All-Star game has changed. They're all young guys now. You know, there's the occasional older guy, but you know, you used to see that game full of, you know, guys who'd been in baseball for a long time. You know, you had Derek Jeter, you had Alex Rodriguez, you had Barry Bonds, you know, you had these guys that were like in their mid to late 30s in the All-Star game. And now, completely dominated by young guys under the age of 30. And last night, very interesting, you know, how many guys there were under the age of 25. And baseball financially used to be dominated by guys over the age of 30. The biggest contracts were handed out to those guys. No longer. So baseball really, I mean, undergone a kind of revolution in numbers. And the game is now, the biggest stars are under the age of 30. The guys who make the most money are under the age of 30. And so it's pretty interesting the way statistics have driven Major League Baseball to stop giving older guys gigantic contracts as their careers decline. And then how that's even been reflected in the All-Star Game. Now, the All-Star Game is a reflection of fan voting. And so it's pretty amazing. So I watched that last night. The other thing I did, and we'll talk about it in the second hour, is I did a fair amount of reading yesterday. Now, I will tell you this. You know who the geeks are that listen to this program, because when we talk about things like Confederate artillery at Gettysburg, when the show ends, you know what they do? And I'm one of them, so I know. Right? They go into their library and they start pulling, right? They start pulling books out. Now, I've got a couple books. One is by the name of Harry Fans. It's called Gettysburg, the Second Day. Okay. Now, I bought this book when I was a captain. It's M.F. McNamara, Captain USMC, for $34.95. This book is about the Second Day of Gettysburg, and it is about 400 pages about the Second Day. Yeah. Who is Harry Fans? He's a retired from the position of chief historian of the National Park Service in 1981. So he wrote a book, and with footnotes and maps and all the rest of it. And pretty interesting. And now as I'm going through it, right, I see my highlights and my notes in it. So pretty funny. So geeks bust stuff like that out. The other book I busted out is another one called The Gettysburg Papers by three authors, Bandy, Freeland, and Bierce. Bierce is an old guy that you saw, I believe, in Ken Burns' series, The Civil War. He talks like this, and yeah, that's that guy. So it's a collection, right? It's a collection of scholarly articles about Gettysburg, right? Section 1, The Strategy of the Gettysburg Campaign, written by Brevet Lieutenant Colonel George B. Davis, 1st Massachusetts Cavalry. So it's things that were written. He writes this in 1898. So these guys participated in the action. And so there's different sections to the book. The cavalry at the Gettysburg campaign, strategy. Let me see if you would know any of the writers. Yeah. Well, Beveridge, I don't know if you know him. Rufus Dawes, the 6th Wisconsin at Gettysburg. Dawes, I think, is a regimental or a brigade commander, so he's a pretty famous guy. Let's see. But these guys all fought, and then they wrote afterwards. And so it's a compilation of first-hand accounts and so. So anyway, when you're a dork, you do that kind of stuff. And so what I got later was my arty friend, right? He bombed me. Because remember I said there was an artillery battery in the vicinity of the Peach Orchard that retired by prologue. Well, it's not prologue. It's called prolong. All right? So that's what it's called. And that is when the artillery piece recoils, the ropes that, right, the arty dudes that are hanging around there, and I don't know all the positions, so maybe I should learn this, but as the cannon recoils, they take the ropes and they take the cannon as far as they can drag it. Well, this thing was on kind of a downslope, kind of Plum Run is behind the wheat field and the peach orchard. So that's called retiring by prologue. So the arty guy who kind of took me to task for being so difficult on the, being so hard on the Confederate artillery, he emailed me with a couple of, he said, "Mac, it's Bigelow's battery." And I'm sitting here looking at my, like, I'm buried in geekness, right? And I'm reading about Bigelow's battery, and I find a first-person account of Bigelow's battery, written by who wrote it? Did Bigelow write it? Patrick Brown. Bigelow's battery is actually, I think, the 9th Massachusetts battery. Okay. And it gives a little bit of the history of the battery and how Bigelow comes to command. Bigelow's a Harvard guy. And he quits. And he enlists in the United States Army. Quickly becomes, gets commissioned. And he's an artillery dude. And so he fights in the early battles when the Union's getting smoked and gets wounded, and he's recovering, gets wounded a second time, recovers, and then he gets handed the 9th Massachusetts Battery in January, February of 1863. And he gets told, hey, there's been an Italian dude, like, not just like American Italian, he's like Italy Italian. He's been, you know, helping us, and but he doesn't want to leave Washington, D.C. The morale is low, so Bigelow goes there. And so we'll talk about his exploits in the second hour. But reading first-person accounts, man, I peg the dork meter on this stuff. And I would tell you this. If you go, one of the great things about the Luvos guides when you go to American Civil War battlefields is you'll sit there and go to a spot, and he tells you where to go, and you'll read first-person accounts out of his little thing, which only makes you want to read more and learn more about it. But if you want history to come alive on a Civil War battlefield, yeah. I know, it's pegging the dork meter. So anyway, the arty guy sends me, you know, after he sends Bigelow's battery, and he sends me something. I said, hey, well, check this out. And I sent him the two articles that I copy and paste. And they're amazing, right? Anyway, and I even include a map. But yeah, the amazing thing is, the fight in the wheat field, the fight in the peach orchard is the fight, right? Is the fight. And so, anyway. And then Ohio Man, all of a sudden I get something from Ohio Man. And he's doing the same thing. He's like, hey, it's Bigelow's battery. And he sends me something. So anyway, we're going to talk about Bigelow's battery and retiring from by prologue. And let me just say, you know, this is a tease, right? So now all hell breaks loose in the middle. Well, it's not the middle. Okay. If you draw a fish hook, right? So everybody stop what you're doing. Whatever you have handy, I don't care if it's like the seat of your really expensive pickup truck. Okay. Draw a fish hook on it. Okay. That's the Union line. Okay, at the very top where the fishhook curves, or that would be the bottom, right? So I want you to draw a fishhook, right, but now invert it. So the crooked end goes on top, right? And the pointy point of the hook is to the right. So the hook kind of goes to your left, and it ends, you know, towards you. All right, so that's the fishhook. So that's the Culp's Hill at the top. Now, halfway down the long axis of the hook, cut it in half. Now take that part and push it further to the left. That's Sickles. At the bottom of that segment is the peach orchard. Okay. Now, so that's the situation that Bigelow gets sent to. like, hey, go help those guys out in the peach orchard, because they're about to get schwacked. But anyway, so Meade thinks he's got the fish hook, right? But Sickles owns the southern half of the fish hook, and he pushes out towards the Emmitsburg Pike. And he now, like, screws up the whole Union defense by giving them a flank that they didn't have initially, that they had to fight to get to. So, as he does that, Longstreet is coming from that direction. And so, there's a meeting engagement that takes place. The Peach Orchard, and then the wheat field, and then to the right of that is Devil's Den, and to the right of that is Little Round Top. And you have Union forces coming from the backside, and you have Confederate forces coming from the front side. And they get it on. And so Bigelow is in the midst of that. So this shitstorm is going on. And Bigelow's is trying to get his guys out of the Peach Orchard after they stand and fight. And they're fighting at close quarters. In fact, I think at some point they do what's called they double shot, which means they put two canisters of grape and they're essentially big ball bearings, right? So they're machine guns. And the Confederates get close, people go down. Right? So you can imagine this. So now he's like, I gotta get out of here. So then the battalion commander comes up to him. And he says, hey, you can't leave. Like, huh? Right? Captain Bigelow says, quote, just as I was limbering up to go through the gateway and back to the ridge, right, which is Cemetery Ridge, where the Union defense is, Colonel McGilvery, who commands this whole thing, dashes up and says, Captain Bigelow, there is not an infantryman back of you along the whole line from which Sickles moved out. Yeah, it ain't supposed to be like that. You must remain where you are and hold your positions at all hazards and sacrifice your battery, if need be, until at least I can find some batteries to put in position and cover you. The enemy are coming down on you now. And then Bigelow says, I immediately ordered the guns unlimbered, ammunition taken from the limbers and laid behind the guns. Hardly were four guns double-shotted before the enemy appeared above a swell in the ground. So they're actually on a reverse slope, which helps them because they're not getting schwacked by other artillery. About 50 yards on my right and front, I became heavily engaged. So we'll talk about that. I'll read you a little bit about it. But it's incredibly interesting how well the Union artillery was handled at Gettysburg. And, you know, and again, and there's a number of instances where, given all the mistakes that the Army of Northern Virginia made, they came within a whisker on a couple different times of writing that story very differently. So we'll talk about that. The other thing I want you, somebody sent me a link yesterday and said, hey, Mac, I haven't heard you talk about this. It is a speech of Army Staff Sergeant recently awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions during the fight in Fallujah in November of 2004. He is Army Staff Sergeant David Bellavia. And so you'll hear that speech in the second hour. So you'll hear that speech. We'll talk a little bit about, we'll finish our discussion about artillery at Gettysburg. Ohio man, yes, I'm a geek. And then he says, no, I just got those books in the mail yesterday. I ordered midday Monday, and they showed up on my doorstep 24 hours later. Pretty scary. You know what? It's getting to that point, right? That if you live in a major urban area, they may deliver that day. That's scary. Yeah. Anyway, the world as we know it. There's a ton of stuff in the news today that you should be concerned with. Yeah. So we'll talk about that. So good morning to you. Thanks for listening to All Geek Radio here. And whatever you do, don't touch that dial. The United States Marine Corps Band makes this morning official, this 10th day of July. Good morning to you. Dedicated to a guy who plays baseball for the New York Mets. He won the Home Run Derby. His name is Pete Alonso. All right. And Pete is a military kid. And he donated a portion of that which he won. He won $1 million. And he donated part of it to the Wounded Warrior Project, and then another part of it he donated to the 9/11 Fund. And, you know, how cool is that, right? And so he donates 5% of his winnings to Wounded Warrior Project, and I think another 5% to the 9/11 Fund. And so, how about that for a great example? You know, in a day and age where, you know, we see athletes, you know, I'm not going to the White House, right? It's about me. And then they go on their political rant like anybody gives a shit what they think politically. And you know, we just get that stuff shoved down our throat. Pete Alonso, right, earned $1 million in the Home Run Derby. He's given 5% to the Wounded Warrior Project and another 5%. So he's given $50,000 each to the Wounded Warrior Project and the Tunnels to Towers Foundation, which raises money for the first responders. And so, you know, so this is dedicated to Pete Alonso, who, and again, he's a military kid. So good on you, Pete. Pretty good example for the rest of us, and God bless you for doing what you're doing in the spirit of things that are right. So this dedicated to a young first baseman. I want to say Mike, 23 years old, that plays for the New York Mets. Well done, bruh.
Our flag comes through to America. You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Somebody sent me an email. Hey, Mac, are you going to retire? The Commandant's, we got to win when he retires? No. We got to see what kind of game Berger has. All right, we'll check the weather now. Let me read you another email. Mac, please read this live on the air. First of all, I don't know that much about the Civil War. I now know more about the artillery on day two at Gettysburg than I know about the artillery in Vietnam or Korea. Just wanted to thank you. On a serious note, I've actually got interested because of the way the humans are portrayed in all of this, attempting to do their duty as something incredible unfolds in front of them. Interesting human drama. So, thank you, kind of. You're welcome, kind of. If you know, some people don't like it. I love it. I love the human drama, right? I mean, Bigelow doesn't know that Gettysburg is going to be Gettysburg. He's just, you know, he's just commanding his battery. So, the weather. currently mostly sunny and 84 in Quantico. It is sunny and 86 at Camp Lejeune. Sunny and 84 in 29 Palms. Clouds of 67 at Pendleton. Dark cloudy and 78 in Camp Smith in Hawaii. In Okinawa, dark cloudy at 83. In the Al Anbar province of Iraq, it is sunny and 107. Yeah. In Afghanistan, in Marja, it is clear, dark, and 98 degrees. And at the home of All Marine Radio, Costa Mesa, California, 68 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Looking for a high of 77 today, 79 tomorrow, and 82 on Friday. Boom. How about that? All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. But a whole bunch of news to check. We'll check on that. And then you can hear a Medal of Honor speech that somebody sent to me and said, hey, Mac, I think your listeners would find this very interesting. And so the nation's most recent Medal of Honor recipient is a staff sergeant who fought under the command of 1MEF in the Second Battle of Fallujah, Al-Fajr as it's known, in November of 2004. So you're going to hear a speech that he made. There are no speeches other than the president makes some remarks at the formal presentation at the White House. So, the recipient is, can make remarks, at the presentation of his Medal of Honor flag. And so you're going to hear Staff Sergeant Belladilla, his speech that somebody sent me and said, hey, I think your listeners would find this pretty cool. So you'll hear that. And so we'll do that. But as I said, there's a whole bunch of news in the news, right? Which would be, like, normal. But there's, like, significant news in the news. Yeah, which would be abnormal. All right. So, stand by for news. We'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. On your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I wanna walk into a cold, bitter ocean, feel the sting of letting.
Here's another email. 400 pages about the second day? Yeah, that's nothing. The book, the other book that I'm looking at, is 1,100 pages, called The Gettysburg Papers. Yeah, there's all kinds of cool stuff in there. Here's an essay right at the end. General Lee at Gettysburg, written by the Reverend James Powers Smith, formerly aide-de-camp to General Ewell. Read before the Southern Historical Society on April 4th, 1905. Now imagine how careful that dude had to be. You're going to write about Robert E. Lee? You better be careful, son. Because, what they call that guy, the Marble Man. Right? Legendary. But he made mistakes. But nobody really wanted to point those out. So, but anyway, I love reading those first-person accounts. The my favorite of all the ones that I've run across is General Lee's engineer, who gets up on the morning of the second day, and he comes back and says, gives Lee a picture of the battlefield that isn't accurate. So from the get-go, Lee thinks one thing when actually something else is true. Lee thinks there's less guys there than there are because the engineers, they're his reconnaissance guys. They don't see a whole group of guys that are there, and there are more that are coming. So anyway, but it talks about, you know, he's sleeping near the fire near Lee's tent when Lee comes and wakes him, you know, early, like at 3 a.m. of the second day, and says, okay, and over a map, over a lamp, Lee says, I want you to go look at this, 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 and this, and this, and this. And he talks about going on the route. Captain S.R. Johnston, which is my favorite. So anyway, so if you want to really peg the dork meter, you find stuff like that. All right, time to look at the news. And stop being a dork. Let's see. The Chinese are in the news today. All right. China urges the U.S. to immediately cancel sale of tanks and missiles to Taiwan. Now let me just say this: do we dance to anybody else's tune around the world? No, I don't think we do, right? I mean, look what's going on between in Eastern Europe, where Russia is constantly, you know, we have drones in the Black Sea. We're selling more and more weapons to the Ukraine. We sell weapons to, you know, we're going to build a base, and we're going to build Fort Trump in, you know, in Poland. Do we dance to anybody else's tune? Like, the Chinese seem to think that, you know, that they can call the shots everywhere. Again, China's got to come into the 21st century, man. China's demanding that the United States scrap a plan to sell more than $2 billion worth of military hardware, including the M1A2 Abrams tanks and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles to Taiwan. Such a deal violates international law, norms of international relations, the One China policy, interferes in China's internal affairs, undermining the nation's sovereignty and security, according to foreign spokesman Zheng Shuang in a conference with reporters on Tuesday. China's internal affairs, right? Except Taiwan's an independent nation. Oh, that's right. Even though it has no historical evidence to bear out the claim, China claims Taiwan. I mean, it's just bullshit. Under One China, the U.S. acknowledges Beijing view that it has sovereignty over Taiwan, but considers its status as unsettled. And again, that notion based on, you've heard Grant Newsham talk about, there's been no time, right? I want to say except for very briefly when Taiwan held any sway or mainland China held sway on Taiwan. Anyway, quote, the Chinese side is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposed the U.S. plan to sell arms to Taiwan, Gang said. We have lodged stern representation with the U.S. side on this. So that would be akin to our stern representations of our views relative to militarizing the South China Sea that you said, go ahead, stick it up your ass? Like that? Oh, but that's a one-way street, eh? Oh, maybe it's not. So fuck off. Oh, did I say fuck off? I thought I was just thinking it. And what a joke, right? What an absolute clown show. He called on the U.S. to immediately cancel the deal before it harms the country's ties and peace and stability in the region, which China, we all know from the Nine Dash Line that we've been educated about, the Spratly Islands, the Paracel Islands, all of that, which China now claims, right, and fortifies that we, the United States, is the threat in the region. Right. The sale could include 254 Stingers and 108 Abrams tanks, hundreds of machine guns, ammunition, other equipment, according to statements by the Pentagon's Defense Security and Cooperation Agency, announcing the State Department's assent to the deal on Monday, worth more than $2 billion with a B dollar. Yeah. There have been recent moves by the United States showing commitment to Taiwan, where Grant Newsham has been hanging out. That includes visits by senior officials. And Taiwan was referred to as a country in an Indo-Pacific strategy report released last month by the Department of Defense. Right. A country, right? That's different than being part of China. All right, here's some guy named Baker, is quoted in the story. According to Carl Baker, executive director of the Pacific Forum think tank in Hawaii. So Baker says this, quote, referring to them as a country, he's speaking of that. That has symbolic significance. We're trying to show that we really do support Taiwan as an independent entity without going beyond what we are required to do under the One China policy, he said. Yeah, the One China policy, right? But, you know, that was political expediency. Political expediency, and it was done because, you know, look, mainland China, hell, they can't even get their own shit together, let alone impact Taiwan, which has a robust modern economy. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? So, yeah, what, low 30 years later, it ain't that way anymore. So anyway, that in the news this morning. Another interesting little news. Two of my favorite nations, China and Germany. Listen to this. In a first, Chinese military deploys for medical drill with German forces in Europe. Yeah. What? Stuttgart. The Chinese army, for the first time, has deployed armored medical vehicles and personnel to Europe to conduct training with the German military, marking a groundbreaking foray into NATO territory. The exercise, dubbed Combined Aid 2019 and involving about 100 Chinese People's Liberation Army medics, is a joint drill in the Bavarian town of Feldkirchen, focused on responding to a simulated cholera outbreak. The exercise takes place at a time of growing strains between the German government and the Trump administration over a range of issues, including Berlin's laggard defense spending and Germany's support for natural gas pipeline from Russia. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So not only do they not pull their own share of the weight, freeloading Germany, now they've invited the Chinese to play. Yeah, no problem. Come on up. I mean, are you shitting me? Germany forgets, man. Germany forgets. You could have completely been a satellite of the Soviet Union. But the free nations of the West saved your shit. But you don't owe anything to them. Right, just do whatever the fuck you want. Germany, man, has a special, you know, is a special boil in my ass. Or on my ass, I should say. Next headline. Secretary Spencer could be acting SecDef if Trump nominates Esper to the top Pentagon job. Okay, so let me explain this to you. If the Secretary of the Army gets nominated to be the Secretary of Defense, he can't wear both hats, right? Esper's currently acting. When he gets nominated, he has to revert back to being Secretary of the Army while his nomination is considered. So Spencer would have to split up and be SecDef while that happened. And then if he's confirmed, then Esper becomes SecDef. Spencer goes back. If not, Spencer stays as SecDef until we fill the position. All right? We fill the position. So, that in the news today, along with the Chinese going to Germany. What a clown show. New commander of Naval Forces Japan also led the inquiry into the Fitzgerald. There's some more interesting news about the Navy. And we'll talk about that. U.S. Naval Forces Japan bid farewell to a retiring commander and welcomed the new one yesterday in a theater at the Yokosuka base. Rear Admiral Brian Fort, a surface warfare or shipborne officer by training, assumed command from Rear Admiral Gregory Fenton, a naval aviator who held the post the last 2 years. Yeah, Fort was his name prominent in the events after the collision of the Fitzgerald. That in the news today. Before we go, well, it's a Navy Times kind of an event. All right, some from Marine Corps Times. Well, let me go to United States Naval Institute news. California earthquakes leave Naval Station China Lake not mission capable. It's by Gidget Fuentes. We like Gidget. She does good work. Two major earthquakes that struck Southern California late last week opened fault lines on Naval Air Weapons Station China Lake and prompted officials to evacuate residents since Saturday. The Navy testing installation has been declared not mission capable until further notice. Now, this is big stuff, man, because sometimes the repairs are deemed too expensive and they close installations over stuff like that. So, yeah. So then we talk about the safety of the workforce and all that. But right now, China Lake, not mission capable. A lot of weapons development goes on out there. Another story, kind of interesting. Navy declares unmanned MQ-8C scout helicopter mission capable. So the Navy's got... Now, you remember the Army helicopter? What would I call it? The Iroquois? It's not the Cobra. It's smaller than a Huey. U.S. Army helicopters. Let me think of the name. Let me find the picture and I'll tell you what it looks like. It's this thing right here. Kind of, sort of. The UH-72 Lakota. So if you look up what a Lakota looks like, this is kind of the same kind of looking thing. The Navy declared its MQ-8C Fire Scout unmanned helicopter mission capable, ready to deploy aboard littoral combat ships. The IOC, which is Initial Operational Capability Declaration, comes after the Navy rethought how it was going to use the aircraft. A little more than a year ago, the Navy was still testing how Fire Scouts could be used to repel swarm attacks of small attack crafts. By this spring, the Navy scrapped those plans in favor of loading the aircraft with sensors to provide the LCS with superior over-the-horizon targeting capability. So, it's a drone, right? You shoot it out there, and you're essentially risking nobody's life by having this sensor out there that's both collecting and emitting. And, so all your radar arrays are able to be extended over the horizon. So there you have it. There you have it. So the Navy with a new drone. So that in the news today. There's one more story, and I'll get to it later, but about the Navy, and that is Secretary of the Navy supposedly supposedly is looking at 3-star candidates to be the Chief of Naval Operations in addition to 4-star candidates. And it's interesting because Jeff Zulowitz yesterday said that because of the Fat Leonard thing and because of, other events that have caused the relief of senior admirals in the Navy, that the talent pool is thinner than normal. So will the Secretary of the Navy reach below 4 stars to come up with the next SecNav? So that's kind of an interesting little story in terms of Marine Corps stories. Here's one this is about General Dunford, but U.S. proceeding with plan for coalition to deter Iranian threats. Evidently, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff got together with a small group of reporters yesterday at Fort Myers. Yesterday, Marine General Joe Dunford said the Pentagon has developed a specific plan that he believes it will be clear within a couple of weeks which nation will be joining the effort. Right? The United States will move ahead with that plan to build a coalition of nations to monitor and deter Iranian threats against commercial shipping in the Persian Gulf area and in a heavy traffic waterway between the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa. Mark Esper, the acting Secretary of Defense, raised the issue last month with Allied officials at NATO headquarters, but no nations were ready to commit to participating. Esper said at the time that the plans would have to be refined. Dunford said he discussed the matter Tuesday with Esper and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and the plan is coming together. Quote, "We're getting ready to move out," Dunford told a small group of reporters at Fort Myers in Virginia. We have a pretty clear concept of what we want to do. He suggested the project could be handled by a small coalition. Quote, "This will be scalable, so with a small number of contributors, we can have a small mission, and we'll expand that as the number of nations that are willing to participate identify themselves." He said the U.S. military's main role would be to provide maritime domain awareness, intelligence, and surveillance information to the ships of coalition partners that would conduct patrols in vulnerable waterways like the Straits of Hormuz, which separates the Persian Gulf from the Gulf of Oman, as well as the Bab al-Mandeb, a heavily trafficked strait between Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula. Any escorting of commercial ships would be done by military ships sailing under the flag of the commercial vessel. So American ships would escort American vessels if it came to that, right? And then other ships from other nations would escort their own. So that would be the way that would work. But the United States would provide umbrella ISR for all of that happening in the region, and that would be the American responsibility. Another pretty interesting story from the Associated Press. Washington's peace envoy aims for a September 1st agreement on troop withdrawals after an all-Afghan conference. So, Afghanistan. All-Afghan talks that brought together Afghanistan's warring side ended Tuesday with a statement that appeared to push the country a step closer to peace by laying down the outlines of a roadmap for the country's future and ending nearly 18 years of war. Washington's peace envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, said that he is hoping for a final agreement by September 1, which would allow the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops. But he will begin an eighth round of peace talks with the Taliban later on Tuesday in Qatar's capital of Doha, where the two-day conference was held. Tuesday's statement said that a post-war Afghanistan would have an Islamic legal system, protect women's rights within the Islamic framework of Islamic values. What does that mean? Wait a minute, they don't have rights. Yeah, that's code for Taliban is going to run the show. What? And ensure equality for all ethnic groups. That's never happened. The much-touted conference was attended by the Taliban, Afghan government representatives, women, and members of the country's civil society. It aimed to produce a new level of consensus among Afghanistan's fragmented society. There was no mention of a ceasefire, which Khalilzad said the negotiations on a final deal would address. Both sides did agree, however, to do more to protect civilians. The United Nations has expressed growing concern over the number of civilian deaths in the conflict. Right. You know, life is cheap. Life is cheap in that part of the world. And so, I don't know. I hear that stuff. Like, that to me, this statement is just total gobbledygook. Right? Tuesday's statement said a post-war Afghanistan would have an Islamic legal system, protect women's rights, quote, within the Islamic framework of Islamic values. What does that mean? What the hell does that mean? And ensure equality for all ethnic groups. That's never happened. So, again, you're telling me that, I don't know. That's like, yeah, we'll tip over Iraq, and we'll go to Baghdad, and then we'll bring in these expats from the United States, The Iraqis will welcome them, and then we'll leave. It'll all be cool. Yeah, no, we'll expand the ground war in Afghanistan, and then we'll kind of do our thing, and then and we'll cool everything out, and it'll all be good. It doesn't work like that. So, again, to me, fairy dust is not a solution. And how you reconcile the aims of the Taliban government with Jarrah is, to me, which will be very, very interesting to watch, because I don't see it happening. All right. Top five stories in Early Bird. Number one, Army-Navy face big shakeup on the road to confirming the next SecDef. We've kind of talked about that, right? Esper, the SecDef now. So the Army needs a new Secretary of the Army, unless Esper doesn't get confirmed as the SecDef, but by all indications he will. In the meantime, Spencer goes to become SecDef, and there's an interim or acting. His deputy takes over to run the Department of the Navy. Number two, war powers debate teed up for the defense policy bill. This is just a political event. It will go nowhere because the Republicans own the Senate, but here you have it anyway. The Democrat-controlled House is expected to vote this week on several measures to limit the president's power to wage war on Iran and aid the Saudi war in Yemen after clearing a key procedural hurdle on Tuesday night. The House Rules Committee, which screens amendments to the chamber's legislation, met Tuesday night and approved 437 of more than 650 amendments submitted for consideration by Republicans and Democrats, covering a broad array of topics and limiting the president's power is one of them. So that will be taken up by the House of Representatives. But it's largely theatrical in nature because it won't go anywhere. The third story, Pentagon spent $1.2 million to support the Salute to America event on the 4th of July. So, much, much ballyhooed, right? Much ballyhooed. Number four, what the U.S. needs to counter unprecedented Chinese influence in South America. Yeah, in South America. This is in Defense News. As China continues to expand its global footprint, the Pentagon's top official for South America is sounding a clear alarm. China's influence in the region has reached unprecedented levels of influence and leverage and will require a whole-of-government approach from the United States to counter that. Admiral Craig Faller, the head of U.S. Southern Command, told the Senate Armed Services Committee's Emerging Threats Subcommittee that China is only going to increase its efforts to live outside our own neighborhood, seeking to displace the United States as the partner of choice and weaken the commitment of our partners to the rule of law and democracy. So, you deal with China, you get money, but you got to pay it back. We all know that, right? Right? Ask Sri Lanka, okay? Or you sign over your country to them. So, with that money, what do you have to do, right? No, you run your affairs as you decide. So, anyway, so concern in South America. Quote, China plans to increase trade with the region to $500 billion by 2025, with 19 nations in the region now participating in the One Belt, One Road initiative and pledges of at least $150 billion in loans. Beijing is transplanting the economic heft their own economic heft into political influence. So here you go. Do business with us. We'll give you loans. The Southcom head shared an anecdote at a meeting with a regional chief of defense who was receiving around $1.5 million from the U.S. in security assistance. China, the chief said, had offered up to $23 million in cash. And while the official was quick to say his country did not use that money on any IT investments, Admiral Fowler did wryly note that it wasn't just to buy uniforms either. That's the challenge we're competing with, Fowler told the committee. We're not going to compete in volume. We have to compete in quality and speed of relevance. But the insinuation is, right, that you can clip some of that money for yourself. We want influence. He goes on, I'll read this, because it's really interesting, because you don't see this happen in public very often. Frankly, China and Russia can't compete with our system. They're trying. They are in the area. Everywhere I go, the chiefs of defense say the Chinese have come. They've offered us free education, unlimited travel, opportunity to go to their schools, Fowler said. The message I get from our capable partners is, we don't want to train with them. We want to continue to train with the United States. So, interesting. The Chinese. Couple more stories. This one's out of military.com. The headline is, sending the right signals on the way to an Afghan peace deal. Written by Mark L. Eder. Oh, I'm sorry. Mary Eder. Mary Eder retired after 36 years in the U.S. Army at the rank of Major General. She served as the former Deputy Chief of the U.S. Army Reserve. She is now a fellow at the American College of National Security and Leaders. The article starts, so it's kind of an opinion piece, right? The hour for peace has come, so said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during a June 25th trip to Kabul, Afghanistan. After four straight decades of war, the hope for lasting peace is on the minds of Afghans across the Central Asian country. Establishing a peace deal in Afghanistan is like carrying a massive boulder up a long mountain. It's far more likely you will slip and tumble rather than reach the peak. But when the only other alternative is more war, poverty, and devastation, negotiations become a lot more appealing. The Trump administration has rightly established some non-negotiable bottom lines in its talks with the Taliban. First, Afghanistan must never again present a terrorist threat to the American people. Two, a political resolution to Afghanistan's problems must be solved by the Afghans themselves. After 18 years, it is folly to believe that policymakers in Washington can draw up a solution. And three, U.S. financial and intelligence support to Kabul will depend in part on the Afghan government's ability to protect the rights and liberties of all Afghans. Washington has been correct in demanding that the Taliban's renunciation of Al-Qaeda, the very terrorist group that compelled the U.S. to enter the war in Afghanistan in the first place. And you've heard the chairman talk about that, right? That, you know, hey, we have an enduring mission. And that is a counterterrorism mission. And then the second issue, you know, for the United States is the civil war that goes on in Afghanistan. The article, I'll skip to the end. Why should the Taliban believe threats coming from U.S. officials? Simple. Because the group experienced firsthand the extent to which the United States will go in protecting its people. In October of 2001, the U.S. air campaign began. 2 months later, the Islamic Emirate was gone and Taliban fighters were struggling to find shelter. It's highly unlikely the organization would want to learn the same lesson twice. Diplomacy is all about communicating the right signals. Sometimes the situation calls for deftness in order to keep all sides at the negotiating table and expand the prospects for diplomacy. But in other cases, countries are required to be strong stewards of their position in order to limit misunderstandings and remove any ambiguity an adversary may hold. With the Taliban, the United States should be forceful and unmistakable. We'll see. We'll see what comes out of that. An article in CBS News relative to these all-Afghan talks. Afghans cautiously optimistic after talks with a more flexible Taliban. This is actually comes from Reuters by a guy named Ahmad Mukhtar. 2 days of talks between the warring parties in Afghanistan that ended on a positive note. Delegations from the Afghan government and the Taliban's political team managed to agree on a rough outline for a path to a potential end to the 18 years of bloodshed. The Trump administration's envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, said after the intra-Afghan talks in Qatar that he was hoping a final agreement could be reached by the beginning of September. Once that happens, the U.S. said it can order the withdrawal of the United States and NATO forces. The Taliban representatives at the intra-Afghan dialogue agreed to halt attacks on religious sites such as mosques and madrasas, schools, universities, hospitals, markets, residential areas, and public places. Good God, man. How shitty can you be? The stated goal is to reduce civilian casualties to zero. Well, yeah, no shit. Attacking markets, hospitals, universities... Right, those are legitimate military targets, right? Wrong? I mean, come on. What a joke. Taliban spokesman Suhail Shaheen said on Monday that the inter-Afghan talks had brought the country closer to peace and added that once a timeline for the withdrawal of foreign forces was announced, the Islamic extremists would be willing to enter direct negotiations with the Afghan government and discuss a broader ceasefire. Wait a minute, it can't happen like that, though. Anyway. Skip to the end. They could not agree on denouncing and ousting foreign fighters and terrorists, he said. Also, they refused to recognize and respect Afghanistan's current international commitments, especially those commitments pertaining to women's rights. He said he hoped these issues would be the subject of ongoing discussions with the Taliban in negotiations with the government soon. In a reminder of the tenuous and non-binding nature of the agreement reached in Doha, there was fresh bloodshed in the Taliban's heartland of the Helmand province in southern Afghanistan on Tuesday. Provincial spokesman Omar Zwak told CBS News that an explosion inside a private clinic on Tuesday afternoon left a doctor dead and 2 patients wounded. Zwak said an investigation is underway. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast. But the Taliban are the only militant group active in Helmand. So, cautiously optimistic. Grant Newsham says, look, you can have a deal, right? You just got to get on your knees and take the deal the Chinese want to give you. So I think the same thing's applicable here. You could have a deal. She's got to agree to what the Taliban want. That women's rights will be respected in the context of Islamic law and the Islamic culture? What does that mean? Right? What does that mean? Stay in the compound? That's exactly what it means. So, again, I don't rightly know how you square the two. And here's another kind of a policy article. House Democrats, please pass a bipartisan defense policy bill. So again, last time, we had split Congress, right? Democrats, Republicans, each controlling a section. Sequestration was the rule of the day. And it did a fair amount of damage to the Department of Defense. So, this headline, right? It's under the guise of Congress and the budget, right? House Democrats, please pass a bipartisan defense policy bill from a website called Breaking Defense. Let me see. It's written by a guy named Rick Berger, a former professional staffer on the Senate Budget Committee. He's a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute these days. Hell Hath No Fury like a lawmaker betrayed. This week, the House will take up the crucial National Defense Authorization Act, Congress's primary instrument to oversee the U.S. military. Though the NDAA has passed for 58 straight years, partisan political choices threaten to end that streak. The Democratic House passed out of committee the National Defense Authorization Act by a vote of 33-20, an abnormally close vote for a bill that garners roughly 60 votes out of, 33 and 24 is 57. So the bill garners 60 votes every year since 2000. So I don't know if that's unanimous, but given some people were absent, it's pretty close to unanimous. Anemic support for the NDAA in the committee derives from Chairman Adam Smith's decision to turn his back on the committee's traditional bipartisanship in its drafting and markup process. The bill contains several poison pill provisions. Republicans could not vote for it, including a $733 million top line that represents flat spending cuts to previous bipartisan conventional missile and nuclear weapons programs and prohibitions on nuclear weapons publicly identified as red lines for GOP members. So, anyway. So, he goes on to talk about this. And again, it's just to me, there used to be, right, in the business of government, compromise, that this stuff got worked out, and we did not make the nation pay for this carnival that goes on in Washington, D.C., and that's a thing of the past. So Adam Smith says top line is $733 billion. So the article goes on. A top line of $750 billion represents 2.3% real growth. Chairman Smith disagrees with the recommendations of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford, and former Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, that the defense budget needs to grow by 3 to 5% per year to carry out the defense strategy. He's concerned about how exactly they calculated that number. But this is ticky-tack math. The military loss $550 billion of buying power under the bipartisan stupidity of the Budget Control Act in recent years. Real growth begins to buy back the lost money, even if the money and the time wasted by sequestration can never be fully regained. This year, the extra $17 billion allows the Pentagon to add personnel so that current service members aren't so overstretched. It authorizes $3.6 billion for military construction so that the military is not punished for the White House's choice to launder border wall funding through the Defense Department. It maintains momentum on long-deferred military modernization, which General Dunford calls his greatest concern for the department. He ends with this. The bipartisan tradition of congressional oversight of the military isn't merely a talking point. Well, maybe it is these days. He didn't say that. I did. Reams of disagreements exist between political blocs about the future of national security, but lawmakers have always managed to put aside pure political calculus and achieve compromise while strongly supporting the U.S. military. Passage of the House NDAA without significant Republican support would signal that one of the few bastions of cross-the-aisle cooperation in Congress, oversight of the armed forces, no longer enjoys such a status. It would be a signal that American voters and American adversaries alike are unlikely to miss. So, Adam Smith, well done, butthead. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to listen to Staff Sergeant Bellavia, his Medal of Honor speech at a ceremony, not that happens at the White House, but there's a second ceremony where he's presented Medal of Honor flag, and you're going to hear that speech, so don't touch that dial. You'll find it interesting. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.